From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Last year, the Rhythm and Blues Hall of Fame named him greatest entertainer in the world.
My mother's maiden name was Elvira Sanchez. This is true, Emmis. And so that means I'm colored, Jewish, and Puerto Rican. When I move into a neighborhood, I wipe it out.
That's Sammy Davis Jr. He died in 1990. His legacy is the subject of a new documentary film screening tonight at the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. We'll hear from Tracy Davis, his daughter, and the filmmaker of the documentary. That's this hour. First, though, last week our break room gang talked about how women are socialized not to express anger.
I think being angry can mean that you recognize your own powerlessness. So I think movements can build on anger, but I don't think it's the most productive way to...
I disagree. I think it's a catalyst for change. I think people have to recognize what's happening, and maybe it doesn't come out as anger in a typical sense, but I think you have to realize you get to a certain point, like this Me Too movement, and then people say, enough.
That was Kathy Lohr and H.B. Cho. Here are your first thoughts.
Hello, this is Jillian Ford. I live in Marietta, Georgia. We can both be socialized to be a certain kind of way, but there are always, throughout history, going to be the people who resisted that socialization or that oppression.
We love getting your thoughts and ideas. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Getting the flu is at best unpleasant. At worst, it can kill you. 7 more Georgians died from the flu this month, bringing this season's statewide death toll to 12. And many more people end up in the hospital. In Metro Atlanta, public health officials have tallied over 400 hospitalizations because of flu. That's according to Georgia Health News. The Centers for Disease Control recommend nearly everyone above the age of 6 months get an influenza vaccination. But people still seem to have questions about what these shots are, how they work, and if they're safe. The term flu shot is heard and used all the time, but not well understood. And that means it's time to break it down. Many people don't take flu all that seriously these days. They might be more worried about Ebola or Zika, but influenza is deadly.
You're worried about Ebola. There are 200,000 people a year who go to the hospital, 30,000 who die a year from the virus, from causing the flu.
Before we had vaccines, its victims died by the millions, literally. The epidemic against which all others are measured struck in 1918. The Spanish influenza epidemic killed some 40 million people all over the world. When it first cropped up in Kansas, people thought it was just another flu.
This is fine. I'm okay with the events that are unfolding currently. That's okay. Things are gonna be okay.
But it wasn't. People's lungs would fill with fluid. They often choked to death, sometimes in just one day's time. Some experts say more soldiers died from flu during World War I than from combat.
Oh, God!
Doctors tried many methods to save their patients. Only one worked at all, a blood transfusion from someone who had had influenza and recovered. That basically describes a vaccine. People used to think flu was caused by bacteria, but in 1933, researchers discovered the flu is actually caused by virus types A, B, and sometimes C. Since it's caused by a virus, it can be prevented by a vaccine, and so the race to develop one began.
Wait. So it's like a race?
What are the rules?
There's only one rule. Are you ready? There are no rules. Go!
A group of researchers at Vanderbilt University was able to grow the virus in chicken eggs. And in 1933, another team created the very first experimental influenza vaccine. One of the members of that team was Jonas Salk, the man who developed the oral polio vaccine. Salk was a lifelong proponent of mandatory vaccinations and a dedicated public servant. When he was asked who owned the patent for his polio vaccine, he answered, quote, "There is no patent. Could you patent the sun?" End quote. The Superman of his time, Jonas Salk, was in his last year of medical school when he worked on the influenza vaccine. Not long after, it was administered to thousands of soldiers fighting in World War II, and it was the military that led to mass immunizations decades later. An outbreak of swine flu at Fort Dix in New Jersey prompted President Ford to spur an effort to vaccinate the entire country against influenza.
This virus was the cause of a pandemic in 1918 and 1919 that resulted in over 500,000 deaths in the United States, as well as 20 million deaths around the world.
There is no cure for influenza. It's mostly transmitted through the air when an infected person coughs or sneezes.
My head.
The flu shot is the only vaccination that changes every year. It has to. The flu virus mutates constantly, and scientists have to adapt. Getting one flu shot won't inoculate you forever. What's more, the flu shot is really an educated guess. Scientists at the World Health Organization identify three strains of flu most likely to circulate during flu season. And for those of us in the Northern Hemisphere, they make that decision in February, months before flu season starts. Sometimes they guess wrong, and as a result, the flu shot is less effective. But on average, the flu shot is effective nearly 70% of the time, and it's one of the safest vaccinations available.
Looking good, Billy Ray!
Feeling good, Lewis!
Now, there can be complications and sometimes allergic reactions, but they're really rare. The CDC recommends that almost everyone over the age of 6 months get vaccinated for influenza. Now, if you're one of those who tends to skip the shot, remember this. From 12,000 to 56,000 people die every year from causes associated with influenza. So, pardon the pun, but the flu is nothing to sniff at. We are not experts in influenza or vaccines, so we brought one in. Dr. Robert A. Bednarczyk is a professor of global health at Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health. Did we get that all right?
Yes, that all sounded very good. As you mentioned, influenza vaccine is the best way that we have to try to prevent influenza, which does cause a large number of diseases and deaths every year.
Okay, so let me repeat back what a friend of mine, a very smart, educated friend, said when I asked her if she'd gotten her flu shot. She said, "The last time I got a flu shot, I experienced the most severe case of flu I've ever had in my life." And I hear versions of that. You must hear that all the time. People believe that the flu shot either doesn't help them or actually causes the flu. Is that possible?
It is not possible. And that's one of the most common myths that we hear all the time is that people believe that getting the flu shot will give them the flu. The big problem is that when we give the influenza vaccine over the course of the influenza season, that's not the only disease that's circulating. And there's a lot of other viruses that can cause other similar types of illness that are happening at that same time. And there have been a number of studies that have shown that, individuals who feel like they had gotten influenza after the vaccine, in some cases are actually contracting other viruses with similar types of symptoms.
Why can't we, I read off the range of deaths that experts say are associated with flu, but it's huge. It's tens of thousands of difference between the minimum and the maximum. Why can't we get a more exact number of severe illnesses and deaths that are caused or influenced by the flu?
Well, sometimes it's difficult because not everyone is going to go to the doctor every time that they have flu-like symptoms. A lot of people try to just take care of it at home and try to ride it out. But when we have those severe cases of disease where individuals are going to the doctor or they're going to the hospital, those are being captured. So we're missing some of the people who aren't actually showing up for medical care. So sometimes it's difficult to get those good estimates of just how many people are sick.
And another complaint that you hear all the time is that sometimes they guess wrong, right? That the World Health Organization is not correct in which flu strains will be predominant, and therefore you can get the flu shot and still get the flu. Why does that happen?
So it takes a while to actually produce the influenza vaccine. As you had mentioned, they make the choices of what vaccine types are going to be contained in the vaccine in February, because it takes that amount of time to grow the virus, to inactivate it, to actually produce the vaccine, put it in the syringes and the vials. So that process takes many months. So we have to look at what we know in terms of influenza strains that are circulating at that time. And sometimes that guess can be a little bit wrong. It's less a guess as it is really a good estimate. But even in the 2013-2014 influenza season, there was a change in the strain that was circulating. So our best estimate proved to be wrong. And that was a year that the influenza vaccine did not work as well as we would have hoped.
Is there still a purpose in getting the flu shot, even if it's going to be a wrong guess?
There is, because there's multiple different types of strains of influenza that can circulate every year. There's usually one major one, but in the influenza vaccine, there's typically 3 to 4 strains of influenza that the protection is provided against.
That's Robert A. Bednarczyk, a professor of global health at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. Last summer's chaos in Charlottesville raised a number of questions about Southern identity. An important one is, how do we look at and contextualize Confederate symbols? In Georgia, we have many monuments that honor Confederate soldiers. Decatur, Athens, Rome, and dozens more cities are home to statues and memorials and markers. There have been a number of calls to move or demolish those markers. Here's President Trump's feelings on those efforts.
Was George Washington a slave owner? So will George Washington now lose his status? Are we going to take down statues to George Washington? How about Thomas Jefferson?
We also talked about this with Valerie Babb, director of the Institute for African American Studies at UGA. She says it might be worth it to keep them up so we can understand them better.
What I think we're talking about is rethinking what those memorials represent, because they're not really about the past, they're more about our attitudes towards race and justice today. So I think people who are calling for taking them down probably are really calling for a reevaluation of where we stand towards our history and towards what those monuments represent.
And we've been asking you about this. We visited the Confederate statue in downtown Macon. Here's what Maconite Calvin Watkins had to say about that memorial.
Since I've been in Macon all my life, and it been sitting there, and I'm 74 years old, well, for my part, really, I think it need to come down.
And now it's your turn. We are collecting your opinions, your perspectives on Confederate monuments in Georgia. So call us at 404-500-9457. Leave us a message telling us about a Confederate monument that's near you and what you think should be done about it. You can also post to our Facebook page, of course, or tweet us. We're at OST Talk. And you can also email us. There's any number of ways to reach us. Our email address is onsecondthought@gpb.org.
While we were marching through Georgia, hurrah, hurrah, we bring the jubilee. Hurrah, hurrah, the flag that makes you free. So we sang the chorus from Atlanta to the sea. While we were marching through Georgia.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Most sports are all about teamwork, but underwater hockey takes collaboration to new heights, or depths, I should say, since all the action in underwater hockey is at the bottom of a pool. And because players can't hold their breaths very long, hogging the puck is not an option. GPB's Emily Cureton took a little dip with Atlanta's underwater hockey team, the Swordfish. She brought back this audio postcard from a recent practice.
I'm getting my gear out of my bag. I'm Gia Richardson. We have fins, which will help you swim fast underwater. Scuba mask, snorkel. Have sticks, little short sticks that we use to move the puck around.
So the puck is made of lead. It weighs about 3 pounds, so it'll stay on the bottom the whole time. Andre Savu. I'm from Canada. The players start at opposite ends of the pool, and so they kind of race the middle to the puck on the bottom. Yep. The pool is pretty much 6 feet, 7 inches all across. And then the idea is you get the puck in, you try to push it all the way to the other opponent's goal. We say sticks up, go, and then we start playing.
All right. Sticks up!
Everything that you did led us to score that goal, okay? Yeah. Good push.
My name is Ege Akin. I'm in the American national team for this sport. Your breath is the most important thing there is, because you can't play unless you're down there, right? And like, working out for the sport is more about like getting your lungs ready rather than getting like, you know, fit and cut. And like, you see me, like, you know, I don't have any like six packs or like, you know, like biceps or anything. But my lungs inside, they have like 12 packs, you know.
Monica Rojas Peña. It's weird, but once you're playing, it's really fun. It's like kind of like soccer, the same tactics, underwater. This team is kind of special. We are like an international team. Some of us came from Georgia Tech, so I came here to do my grad school. I'm from Colombia, from South America. So yeah, and there's people from China, people from Turkish. My husband is from Romania and Canada. Yeah, there's people from everywhere.
My name is Brett Solomano. I used to do free diving back in Australia, and this was the best equivalent for me. It's a nice meditation with a bit of cardio and just, you know, working the whole body, because you're pretty, got to be pretty dynamic under the water. Yeah.
Don't just use your arm, but instead turn your whole body, right? And that's what she did, and that's why she was able to take it.
This sport was made so that free divers could, you know, work out some way. So they had to like make up this weird thing.
They are like underwater what?
Here I have a reason to swim. I have a reason to hold my breath. And then you don't even notice that you're pushing yourself beyond limits that you think you have, but really you can push yourself past.
Members of the Swordfish Underwater Hockey Club in Atlanta. Their practices are open to players of all levels, and you can see pictures and get more info at gpbnews.org. That piece was produced by GPB's Emily Curitan. Tonight, a documentary showing in Atlanta tells the story of the only Black Puerto Rican one-eyed Jewish entertainer in the world. That's how singer Sammy Davis Jr. used to describe himself. Just ahead, I'll talk with the filmmaker behind the documentary, screening at the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. But first, let's hear from Sammy Davis Jr.'s daughter, Tracy. A few years ago, she released a book called Sammy Davis Jr., A Personal Journey with My Father. It's based on conversations the two had as he battled throat cancer toward the end of his life. Through stories and a lot of photos, it captures the extraordinary life of one of the original members of the Rat Pack. I talked with Tracy Davis in 2014 for the NPR show Tell Me More. She told me her father, who entered the entertainment industry at a very young age, did not have a traditional upbringing.
He didn't have the traditional family life. He was always working, 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 and trying to become famous. And then once he was famous, especially in the 60s and 50s, before Black people could vote, he was scared that it could be taken away at any minute. So he never had that feeling of being able to relax at home. It wasn't until much later, when he was very well established, that he felt like he could take time off.
Tell me the story, if you would, of how they avoided the laws that were meant to keep very young kids off the stage.
My grandfather was doing a Black version of vaudeville. And number one, I don't think people cared that much about, you know, small Black children, but they billed him as a midget. And they got away with it because no one could believe that someone that small and that young would be that talented.
And he had to wear blackface.
Yes, he did. There's a picture in the book where he's little and he's wearing it, and it just makes me sad. But that's what they did.
I wanted to talk about the song Bojangles. I mean, this is a song that he sang his whole life, and I think he ended most of his concerts with it. And it sounded in the book as though you'd never really known before these conversations what his attachment to that song was. Let's take a listen to a piece of the song first.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you. In worn-out shoes, with silver hair, a ragged shirt, and baggy pants. He would do the old soft shoe.
Now, this song is not about the historical, the real Bill Bojangles. It's about somebody else. But your father described it as having a love-hate relationship with the song. What did he mean?
Well, it became a signature classic song for him. And he would, almost every show, end it with that. And people were disappointed if he didn't sing it. He sings it so well because they're not just lyrics for Dad. It really tells a story. He was always afraid that he would end up like that person. That's what was in his heart sometimes. It's like, I don't want to end up like the person in this song. And he thought for a very long time that he would end up like that.
Tell me about his time in the military as well. And obviously, at this point, we're still talking about things that happened before you were born. But there were some really moving stories about not only the racism and the physical violence he faced from his fellow soldiers, but also a man, Sergeant Williams, who really kind of looked out for him and protected him and went above and beyond.
Yeah, as Dad said, sometimes you find real good and real horrible situations. And I know how rough it was for him and how brutally ugly people could be. But then, like you said, there's people that will protect you. He could always sing and entertain, but he learned how to read in the Army, and that was a big deal because he really didn't know how to read.
Sergeant Williams was one of the men that he was thinking of when he talked about the fact that all the way along, despite terrible racism that he encountered his whole life, there were often white men and women who stepped forward to help him out. And also, one of the major ones was Frank Sinatra, with whom he had a lifelong friendship.
Yes, especially Uncle Frank. He did more for Dad than anybody because he knew of Dad, and Dad wanted to go see him perform, and they wouldn't let him in. And that was one of the first times he said, you either let him in and put a table down front for him. And that kind of really was what cemented the friendship. And Frank was the biggest star in the world. And I think Dad was grateful for that his whole life.
Obviously, one of the reasons the Rat Pack was so successful was the rapport between your father and Frank Sinatra. Let's take a listen.
I start off by having you meet Mr. Frank Sinatra. When somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you.
Well, if you like him, you're going to be wild about me.
I mean, Frank Sinatra was also the best man at your father's wedding to your mother. And many people may remember what a stir that caused because of this interracial marriage at the time. They postponed their own wedding until after the election at which JFK won the presidency because Frank Sinatra was going to be the best man, and Frank Sinatra was very closely aligned with JFK's campaign, correct?
Well, first of all, when my mom and dad were dating, Frank was pretending that, you know, mom was his date. That's how they kind of got around, is that mom was his date, not my dad's. And if my mom went to go stay at a hotel, she would stay on one floor and my dad would stay on another floor. And then at night, they'd go stay together and then separate early enough to go back to their respective rooms. And let me just put it this way. I think that my dad was overjoyed that he stood up for them at the wedding. It meant a lot. Then, you know, it became a thing with my father because after all the campaigning and all the work he did and everything like that, he wasn't invited to the inaugural. And I think that really, Dad never got over that. He really felt slighted.
How was it for you then, growing up in an interracial family? All the racism that your father went through, and much of it is detailed in the book, and it's frankly very painful. How much did that touch you as a child?
A lot. You'd come out sometimes, and there was times that a swastika was painted somewhere, or the N-word was written on a car or a windshield or something like that. But they did make a pretty good cocoon for us when we were really little, because most of their friends were in show business or music, where there was less racism in that, because if you had talent, then it didn't really matter. If you could play an instrument or do something or be a good singer or a good actor, they really didn't care. So it kind of gave me a little bit of a false sense of security, and that's probably a good thing, because otherwise I probably would have been more introverted than I actually am.
I wonder if you'd recount what your father had to say about the African-American community. He was obviously upset that some blacks were angry with him. Some blacks called him an Uncle Tom and claimed that he'd sold out in order to please the white community and sell more albums to white people. What was his response to that?
Well, he was hurt, but I don't think that that's anything new for black artists even today. When you get to a certain level, you kind of have to grow your circle. And I think for the black community at that time, they wanted to have a piece of Sammy Davis Jr., and they didn't really understand that he was giving as much as he could give, and it somehow it just didn't seem good enough. You know, to be called names by your own folks is really hurtful, because then where do you go when times are tough, when your own community, a lot of people don't think that you're part of that community anymore? It's a little scary.
And in light of that, it was especially touching when you were talking about your father's 60th anniversary TV special. And Michael Jackson performed the song You Were There. That's a song that Jackson wrote especially for your father,
mm-hmm.
about the way that he broke down barriers for musicians, especially of color. Let's take a listen to that song.
You took the hurt, you took the shame. They built the walls to block your way. You beat them down, you won the day. It wasn't right, it wasn't fair. You taught them all, you made them care. Yes, you were there, and thanks to you, there's now a door we all walk through.
I mean, I gotta say, having read your book, that song even now makes me all verklempt. What was what was your dad's reaction, and yours also?
Well, I think that Michael really loved my father, and he would sneak sometimes to Dad's shows and sit on an apple box and on the side of the stage and watch him perform. And Dad would say, "What are you doing?" He goes, "I'm just going to steal some of your moves." And he's like, "Okay, you know, that's what entertainers say all the time. I'm just going to steal some steps." And if anybody has seen that show, if you look at the outpouring of love between the two, if you see my dad's face. Because Michael came out to do that just for him and wrote it just for him. And he didn't really, he's not known as a guy that does television specials. So it was really moving for Dad. And it was moving for me, too. He's just really respectful of my dad. And I always appreciated that.
So your father said to you during these conversations, just don't let me die here.
Yes.
What did that mean to you?
What it meant was keep me alive, not only in your heart or in our family, but he wanted to have a legacy. He wanted to be remembered and thought about. I have these memories, and I cherish them, and I've ran into so many people, and I still do now when they find out who Dad is, and they'll start asking me questions and whatever, and that makes me feel good that he's still remembered.
So during the whole book, it was a question of whether or not your father would make it long enough to see the birth of his first grandchild. And he did.
Yes.
I wonder now, with your children all these years later, after, as you say, with the grace of time, what is it that you most want to pass on to your family about what you learned from your father?
I think that one of the things I learned from Dad is that even though he went through all those tough racism times and everything, hatred fades, and you bring it up to talk about it, so hopefully you change somebody's mind. Maybe you won't, but maybe they'll take a softer stance. And what I try and teach my kids is the patience that Dad had for the world, but also the love that he had for people, for his job, for his family, and that he didn't, you know, I'm living in the South right now, and sometimes there's still incidents that come up, and you just say to yourself, hello, 2014, and people don't understand that it's still there. So, you know, every once in a while, there's still a little fight left in me, and I try and teach my kids that.
That's Tracy Davis, the daughter of singer Sammy Davis Jr. A documentary about her father's life shows tonight at the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. Just ahead, I talk with the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker behind that documentary. This is On Second Thought.
Don't go to bed with no price on your head. No.
Don't do it.
No, no. Don't do the crime if you can't do the time.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we'll look back at the career of 1920s gospel musician Washington Phillips. A new album features several of his mostly unheard works, and that album is up for a Grammy. The Grammys are this Sunday. So, who are you rooting for? Are you going to watch the Grammys? Call us at 404-500-9457, and be sure to join us tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. for that conversation. Tonight, the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival pays tribute to an icon. Sammy Davis Jr. wore many hats: World War II veteran, civil rights activist, singer, dancer, member of the fabled Rat Pack. A documentary showing at the film festival tells his story. It's called Sammy Davis Jr., I've Gotta Be Me. And I spoke with the film's director, Sam Pollard, last week. So you start this documentary with one of the most controversial parts of Sammy Davis's life. Why start the story there?
Well, you know, when we started thinking about how to construct this film, we started to think about what was the best way to give the entry point to the story of Sammy. Quite honestly, initially, I started with a clip from an old television show called What's My Line, where the mystery guest would sign in, and the John Daly said, will the mystery guest sign in, please? And it was Sammy Davis Jr., and then he did some impressions to fool the panelists, and they figured out it was Sammy Davis. That was sort of my initial open. But then after we looked at our first cut, the executive producers and the possible distributors said, can't there be something more dynamic and stronger way to get into the film, a real gut grab or something that's going to really pull the audience in? And we started to think about it, and we thought, what is the most sort of tumultuous period moment in Sammy's life? When he hugged Nixon in 1972. And so that's why we started to open up with the whole Nixon, the Rat Pack. These are the things that people who know about Sammy Davis remember: his relationship with Sinatra and Dean Martin, and the hug of Richard Nixon. So that's why we decided to go that way, something that was going to grab the audience and immediately pull you in.
Well, then let's hear a clip from your film. Here's a phone recording of President Richard Nixon describing Davis's stay at the White House.
We had Sammy Davis here last night, and he was just great, absolutely great. And he spent the night. I didn't know it, because I thought with the Kennedys and the Rat Pack, this is the first time he had ever performed at the White House, and the first time an American black has ever stayed overnight in the White House.
Isn't that great?
I didn't announce it, of course. I didn't say it. And I said, Sammy, I think you, I said, have you ever said? And he said, yes, I know. I said, I don't want to exploit it. He says, I know.
And so it seems like at least part of the film's mission was to give him more context. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of things. I mean, I've always philosophically felt as a filmmaker, when I'm doing a documentary about a so-called celebrity or celebrity, I don't want to just do a documentary that's going to look at, you know, the positive aspects of his life. I want to look at the complexities of his life. I want to look at him, the celebrity, he or she, in the context of the environment and the period they grew up in, or they lived in. So that's why we knew that it was important to give, you know, you understandings about Sammy's relationship to what was happening in the 50s, what was happening in the 60s, and what was happening in the 70s when Richard Nixon was the president of the United States.
And I want to play this comment from Sammy Davis Jr., where he's remembering his younger days. Here he's speaking to David Letterman, and he's talking about his time as a child actor.
I'm going to say a line now that's going to probably cause a great deal of laughter and some consternation. I
appeared in blackface. That means burnt cork, right, with the thing. And I had a little chocolate cigar. Mm-hmm. And they would dress me in their long pants. And I was about the same size I am now. So, so actually, I got away with it. And they said I was a 44-year-old midget.
So what did you feel when you were making this film about comments like this one, this sort of really tenuous space that Sammy Davis Jr. occupied? He was the first to break color lines in a way no one else did, but it's also a space that's a little uncomfortable. The fact that he really did perform in blackface.
Well, you know, what it does is it gives an audience an understanding of what and how America has evolved over the years. If you think back to the times when Sammy Davis Jr. was born, you know, he was born during a time when minstrelsy was part of the American sort of language in terms of entertainment. And what did that mean? That meant that white men and black men and white women, they put on blackface, you know, to emulate black people. And black performers put on blackface to emulate the white people, putting on the blackface to emulate black people, to show you how complicated it is. Now, when you hear that comment that he made to David Letterman, and he says then it would make some people laugh and would make some people feel a little uneasy. Imagine people listening to that today in the 21st century, and it makes them even feel more uncomfortable because the idea of anybody putting on blackface now is like horrific. So it's a really interesting and telling thing about what America was like historically back then and how people react to it today. I mean, it's like my daughters today say John Wayne's a racist. Now, I say to them, I grew up watching John Wayne Westerns, and he may have been complicated in his issues of race, but I saw him in a different light. So it's a very interesting thing to see how people react to these things in today's light.
I'm speaking with Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Sam Pollard. His documentary, Sammy Davis Jr., I've Gotta Be Me, screens tonight at the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. One of the most moving portions of the film, and there were many, one of them was where you were highlighting what happened to him when he was in the military. And his experience in the military was just horrific. So first, let's actually hear Sammy talking about his time in the Army. And in this case, he's speaking to Arsenio Hall.
They painted you white. They poured urine in your beer. Yeah. Things of that nature. I mean, did these things really happen?
Yes, they really happened. They needed to say, hey, man, get that nigga now. Stop him. I tried physically. I got my nose broke 3 times, man.
For me, the reason this was so moving was the movie begins with him being booed by a black audience. And then you move on to what he went through. So what was that like for you as a documentary filmmaker? How did you edit this in a way that was not exploitative but illuminating?
Well, to me, the challenge was to always show you that here is a man who struggled with wanting to be accepted as a major performer in the 20th century, but as a black performer who had to negotiate both white America and black America. So think of it this way. He wants to become a success, but what price does he pay by becoming a success within the black community? Where people in the black community start to say that in the 50s, when he became successful, Sammy Davis has forgotten where he's come from. But then Sammy Davis wants to remind you that, listen, look what I had to go through to get to where I became Sammy Davis. I had to go through, you know, the horrific, you know, confrontations in the Army. I had to go on segregated buses and segregated trains. And now you're telling me I've lost my identity as a black man. And then he's got to deal with the fact that when he does make it successfully to the highest pinnacle in the entertainment industry, he, you know, is a man who's looking for love. He's always looking for affirmation. So when he hugs Nixon, this was something that Sammy did with everybody. He didn't realize the reactions it was going to get. He didn't realize the reactions he was going to get when he went to Vietnam, when America was in the midst of being, many young Americans were anti-Vietnam, you know. So he was always sort of negotiating where his place was in America. And my job as the director was to negotiate that as a filmmaker where you felt like, listen, he's a great man, a great entertainer, but he has to deal with all these other things, and let's do it as delicately and as respectfully as we can, but to make sure you understand what he had to go through.
And through the entire thing, there are reminders of just how great a performer he is. Let's hear actor Billy Crystal. He's talking about Sammy Davis and his dancing here.
The rhythms, the math of what goes on in a genius brain is beyond any of our comprehension. When you think of rhythm that way and it just flows, what is that?
Were there any discoveries you made of maybe some performances that surprised you?
Well, right in that section where Billy talks about the rhythms and in terms of Sammy's dancing, right before that, there's a sequence from a show in the late 1950s or the mid-1950s where Sammy is performing with these two drummers. And then he goes off and he's dancing by himself. I had never seen that footage before. I thought it was breathtaking. I thought it was phenomenal. I knew Sammy was a great tap dancer and a great dancer, but I had never seen that material. So that was a real find to see that material, you know, to see Sammy at his best. Another piece of footage that we found that I thought was really, really important and fascinating was Sammy singing one of his first hit songs, you know, from that Broadway show Pajama Game. I had never seen that footage before. Sammy dancing with all these young dancers with his uncle and his father sitting at a table. I had never seen that footage before. So there was so much material of Sammy that we uncovered, because here was a young man, you know, who never said no, who was on every show you can imagine, from the Ed Sullivan Show to Hollywood Palace to the Merv Griffith Show to, you know, the David Frost Show. This guy not only loved to entertain, but he was also a person who loved to talk and wanted people to understand who he was and how he felt about everything.
So he paid a big price for his mastery, and he talks about the fact that he never got a real education. Let's hear him.
And I resent that, because sometimes I feel so inadequate. And I'm not talking about verbalizing. I'm talking about just sitting down writing. I write like a second, a third, fourth grader, you know, and I can't spell properly.
When I'd see kids bicycling and roller skating and playing ball, my dad would never let me do that, because I'm being a dancer. And I miss that.
So what did you as a director take away from that? What were you trying to tell the audience here?
You know, for that section of the film, I was trying to let the audience understand there were sacrifices that Sammy made, sacrifices unbeknown to him at that young age. Here he was emulating his uncle, you know, emulating his father, Sammy Davis Sr., but understanding also that he was not having a normal childhood. You know, he wasn't out there riding a bicycle. He wasn't out there on the swings. You know, he wasn't going to school on a regular basis. You know, these are the things that he missed. He missed. I mean, in some ways, he had a stunted childhood. As much as he learned on the road as an entertainer, he didn't learn a lot of things as a child. And so many of the things that happened to Sammy as he grew older, the need to have people around him all the time, the need to show off in some ways, came from the fact that, you know, he didn't have a regular childhood. He didn't have what a lot of other young people had growing up. And I wanted people to understand that. But also to understand, too, that when he got to the age of being 19 and 20, when he first went to the Army, he became a reader. He started learning to read. He started learning to understand things. He never became, you know, educated in a literal sense, but he became self-educated, you know.
For those in Georgia who want to see this film, it's playing at the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. And so I guess we should talk about Sammy's chosen faith. He was in this terrible car accident where he literally lost his eye. And in the film, he's talking about a rabbi who came to speak with him as he was recovering in the hospital. And he talks about how conversations with that rabbi made him convert to Judaism.
I know that there is a sort of a kinship between the plight of the Negro and the plight of the Jew, the oppression, the segregation, the constant trying to survive and the trying to achieve dignity. When you're a performer, you deal in such intangibles that you need a religion to hold on to. You really do.
I don't I don't think of Sammy Davis as a particularly religious person. And I guess that's because of all the palling around with the Rat Pack and the drinking and the smoking and the womanizing. So did you come away from your research thinking of Sammy Davis Jr. as a religious man?
I would use the word he was a spiritual man. I mean, he studied Jewish traditions and Jewish religion, you know, very, very, very seriously. So he practiced all the holidays. So, you know, he was an avid believer in Judaism. Now, he was also a flawed human being, so he didn't become a rabbi or anything, but you know, yeah. he needed some sort of spiritual sustenance. He needed some sort of spiritual stabilization. And that's why Judaism was attractive to him, you know. What's interesting is that even when he married My Brit, his second wife, she converted, you know, to Judaism, you know, because Sammy was Jewish.
And as I was finishing watching the film, I wondered, what were your thoughts on the relationship, not just with the Rat Pack, but with Frank Sinatra? Because for a lot of people, that's a big question mark, right? Was this a true friendship of equals? Did Frank Sinatra think of Sammy Davis Jr. as an equal in status or rank or not? What do you think?
I think Frank Sinatra did think of Sammy as an equal in status and rank. But I also think that sometimes Frank Sinatra felt, you know, that he was the bigger man. He was the big brother, you know, and that Sammy was the little brother. I think it was a complicated relationship. I know he loved Sammy. He loved him, you know, tremendously. But there were times when him and Sammy fell out, had disagreements, quarreled, you know. But I think he truly loved Sammy. And Sammy really, really, truly loved Sinatra. You know, Sinatra was the big brother he never had, you know. He wasn't the father figure. He was the big brother that Sammy never had. And you could see that in decade after decade in their relationship.
Emmy Award-winning producer Sam Pollard, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And you can see Sam's documentary on singer Sammy Davis Jr. tonight at 7:30 at the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. Details are at gpbnews.org.
Who can take a rainbow?
Who can take a rainbow?
Wrap it in a sigh.
Wrap it in a sigh.
Soak it in the sun and make a groovy lemon pie. The Candyman.
That's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. So we talked about the life of singer Sammy Davis Jr. Are you a fan of his? If so, what is one of your favorite songs that he did? Call us at 404-500-9457 and sing for us if you can for today. That is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.
You can even eat the dishes. Collect up all the cream, the Candyman.
The Candyman.
Oh, the Candyman can.
The Candyman can.
The Candyman can, 'cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.